This is Lewis Lapham with The World in Time. My guest is the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gordon Wood, speaking with us today about the idea of America. Gordon, you've made America's revolutionary era your life's study, and your new book comes with the title Reflections on the Birth of the United States. That birth apparently took place over a longer period of time than you previously had supposed. How so?
Well, I suppose the idea of America comes out of the Revolution, but it's not something that is instantaneous. In fact, we could say that we're still living out the idea of America. We're still trying to define who we are, what kind of a people we are. So in that sense, the nation building is not over. It's still going on.
Which is why we still ask ourselves, what would Jefferson have said, or what would Washington have done?
That's right. Ordinary people want to know what Jefferson would think of affirmative action, or what George Washington would think of the invasion of Iraq. They have this close identity with these founders, which is, I think, unusual, if not unique to Americans. One cannot imagine the British wanting to know what would one of the two William Pitts think of David Cameron's government. So I think this is an unusual relationship we have with these people. It was a relationship that Lincoln had, and I think Lincoln used the founders effectively to mobilize the Northern people for the long Civil War.
America is, as you say, an idea, more an idea than it is a country or an ethnicity or a national heritage.
Yes, more now than ever before, because we aren't an ethnicity. What kind of a nation are we? We're not the usual kind of nation. There is no American ethnicity. So what holds us together? I think it's this notion of an idea that to be an American is not to be somebody, but to believe in something. And that something we believe in is the ideals, the aspirations that came out of the Revolution: liberty, equality, constitutionalism, not to mention the institutions by which we still govern ourselves. So the Revolution is the important event of our history.
And the notion of republicanism was implicit in it. And what was meant by that, and was how radical was that in the 18th century?
It was republicanism, res publica, public things, was very radical because it was an assault on the existing monarchies that existed everywhere in the Western world and elsewhere as well. And the idea of overthrowing these monarchies and creating a government that was responsive to the people, was controlled by the people, was a radical idea. I mean, republicanism was as radical for the 18th century as Marxism would become for the 19th century.
How did a republic hold itself together? A monarchy could use force and inherited privilege and so forth, but how did a republican government do that?
That's right. The monarchs, like authoritarian governments today, used power from the top down. Republics, which had no monarchs, had none of this patronage, none of the standing armies and religious establishments, had to hold themselves together from the bottom up. So the people had to consent to be ruled, to rule themselves, and this required a certain kind of virtue, a willingness to sacrifice their private interests for the sake of the public good. That's the term that Montesquieu uses to describe this characteristic. It was a classical notion of virtue.
And this was in the head of Jefferson and Washington and Hamilton.
Yes, they all, to one extent or another, some are more doubtful than others of the Americans' capacity to be virtuous. But certainly Washington was obsessed by the idea of virtue. He alone was going to be virtuous, even if all of the ordinary people were not.
How does it translate the republicanism idea of the 18th century into the democratic idea of the early 19th century? How do those two ideas go together?
Well, the term republicanism very quickly meant essentially representative democracy, and that's how they began defining it, even as early as the debate over the Constitution. And by the 1790s, the Democratic Party, or the Jefferson's Party, which starts as the Republican Party, soon is called the Democratic-Republican Party, and by the early 19th century, by 1805 or so, is being referred to as the Democratic Party, the Dems. The two words at that point, republicanism and democracy, become blurred without any great distinction between them.
The Republican, old Republican idea had some notion of aristocracy, that a person's social position or wealth would lend political authority. But then you say one of the most profound revolutions of the past two centuries is the introduction of ordinary people into the political process.
That's right. Well, not just as voters, but as office holders. That really comes as a shock to many of the founders. They hadn't anticipated ordinary folk taking over political leadership. It simply was not something they had expected. They assumed that people would have to go to college, become educated, and become reasonably wealthy in order to hold public office. Public office was not to be a consequence of your social position, but public office was supposed to be a consequence of your social position, not a cause of it. And by the early 19th century, you begin to have people who have no background, no wealth, no education, becoming governors of states.
And that's a truly radical idea, ordinary men representing other ordinary men.
Yes, and that notion of representation comes out in the revolution, when you have revolutionary groups forming, suddenly the artisans say, well, we want representation on that committee, that revolutionary committee. Or the Presbyterians say, we don't have enough Presbyterians on the committee. And then the Scotch-Irish say, you got too many English and not enough Scotch-Irish. And pretty soon you're into the kind of modern interest group politics that we consider normal. It was abnormal for them, and it's the beginning of modern democratic politics, starting already at the revolution.
In another chapter in your book, you talk about the radicalism of Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and their belief in the goodness of all men.
I think that's true, that Jefferson believes that at heart all men have a social or moral sense that links them with other men. And this makes him one of the radicals of the revolution. None of the other founders had believed that to quite the same extent. He has a magnanimous view of human nature. If he could just get the monarchs, the authoritarian rulers out of the way who offer privileges and make distinctions, and then let people love one another, let them relate to one another. He and Paine share that optimistic view, a magnanimous view of human nature, which I think is unusual. And I think it's ultimately, you have to believe, if you believe in a democracy, you have to believe that at some basic level, everyone is the same. Now, we know there are great distinctions. Jefferson knew there were great distinctions between people. But nonetheless, at some basic level, you have to believe that they are the same. And he believed that. He thought slaves had that moral sense, that social sense, as well as white planters. So I think in that sense, he's a true Democrat. And despite his own aristocratic background and the fact that he was a slaveholder, he is, I think, legitimately the spokesman for our democracy and has remained so, I think, for most people. Certainly Lincoln felt so right up into our own time.
That tradition of civic humanism is another important part of the American idea. I mean, the Americans are the only people I know of in the world who, when they meet somebody, a stranger, they think they've met a prospective friend instead of a potential enemy.
That's true. I've often said that despite our great inequalities of wealth, we are the most egalitarian people in the world. It's a kind of psychological equality that we have. I've had arguments with my Australian friends who argue that they are really the most egalitarian people. But I tell them that they have a chip on their shoulder. Those palmy bastards, they say. Their equality comes out of anger. America's sense of equality comes out of a real psychological sense that I'm as good as the next person. No matter how wealthy he is, how many titles he has, I'm as good as the next guy.
Your last chapter in this book comes with the title, The American Revolutionary Tradition, or Why America Wants to Spread Democracy Around the World. Perhaps you could expand on that title.
Well, I think from the very beginning, we thought the American revolutionaries thought their revolution had worldwide implications. It seems arrogant now when you think about how these small number of people, 2 or 3 million people on the edges of Christendom, should believe that their revolution had any importance to the rest of the world, but they did. They thought that this would spread, that the notion of freedom and liberty and that and republicanism, meaning democracy, would spread around the world. They believed that, and they thought that they should encourage that. And they did. They didn't send troops, but they certainly did every other thing they could to encourage revolutions, usually by being the first nation in the world to recognize a new revolutionary regime. There was one exception, a big exception, the Haitian Revolution. We didn't recognize the Haitian government, the Second Republic in the New World, until the Civil War. But otherwise, in Europe, we were always promoting in every way we could, except, of course, we didn't send troops, but promoting revolutions, including the revolutions of 1848. We were always in the vanguard and saw ourselves in the vanguard of revolution.
But we didn't see the Russian Revolution quite the same way. You say the Cold War really started in 1917.
Well, at first, we were very enthusiastic about the Russian Revolution. When the Tsar, in the spring, when the Tsar abdicates, 7 days later, we recognized the new Russian Republic. And Wilson was ecstatic. He thought he now had a democratic partner for his League of Nations. So we were the first nation to do that. But when the Bolsheviks took over in the fall, all that changes. And we became the last major power in the world to recognize the Soviet Union. I think Ireland may have been the last, but we were certainly the last major power. 16 years, four American presidencies, we withheld diplomatic recognition from the Soviet Union. Why? Because I think the Soviet Union represented to us a rival, a threat to the very meaning of America, to the idea of America, if you will, because it had its own revolutionary tradition. It was not a species of the American revolutionary genus, genus Americanus. It was a new genus altogether with its own universalist aspirations, which threatened the very meaning of America. And I think that's why we turned against the Soviet Union for all those years. The war interrupted that because we had a greater threat in Hitler. But the threat that the Soviet Union posed to the meaning of America, I think, is what lay behind the Cold War.
When people say, "I love my country," I mean, we hear this from immigrants, you hear this from people who have been in the country three or four generations. By country, they actually mean idea.
I think so, because we aren't a nation in the usual sense of the term. There's no American ethnicity, especially now compared to the 19th century. There's simply no – the whole world is here. And so we're made up of every race, creed, and color in the world. And so what is it that you identify with when you talk about America except the idea? It's not Starbucks. It's not McDonald's. It's the ideals and values that came out of the revolution – equality, liberty, constitutionalism, and the institutions, of course, that these founders created. All of this is what we mean by the idea of America.
Which you again say is a work in progress, which is why so many people not only refer to the founders, but go back to the Constitution to try to find their new or their own meaning in it. For example, today we have the Tea Party.
Yes, I think they're not always have a sophisticated understanding of the revolution, but I have a lot more sympathy with the Tea Party people than many academics. I think they're struggling to find some sense of who they are, and I think it's natural for Americans to go back to this founding to refresh or reaffirm our sense of what kind of people are we. And given our lack of normal ethnicity, it seems to me perfectly intelligible that these people should try to find meaning in their lives by identifying with the founders. Lincoln did. He said they were flesh of our flesh, blood of our blood. They were part of us. And Lincoln is not easily mocked. So I think we have to have some sympathy for these Tea Party people, even though, of course, they have their own political agenda, as all of us do in some way or another. And so you have to take that into account. But nonetheless, have some sense of why they should try to find some meaning in the founding. I think that's perfectly natural.
How important was the original Tea Party to the American Revolution?
Well, I think it's the most important event in the move up to the revolution. The destruction of all that private property really appalled lots of people, including the Virginians, who were essential to any revolutionary movement. And without the Virginians, of course, Virginia is a fifth of the population. It's the largest colony by far and the most populous, making up a fifth of the population. And if you don't have the Virginians, then you don't have a revolution. And the Massachusetts people took a real risk, Samuel Adams and his group. If the British government had responded moderately, I think the Virginians would not have been on board because they were shocked by the destruction of all of that property. 10,000 pounds, meaning money, millions of dollars by today's standards, it appalled the Virginians, and they might not have joined. But the British had appeased the Americans so often in the events leading up to the 1773-74 that they said, enough is enough. We're not going to back down this time as we have in the past. They had backed down with the Stamp Act. They had repealed it. They backed down with the Townsend duties. They repealed them. Now they said, we're coming in hard. And they came in with the coercive acts, intolerable acts, as the Americans called them, closed the port of Boston, appointed a military general as governor, did away with the Massachusetts Charter, abrogated it, did away with all the town meetings except for one a year. These were real interferences with the Massachusetts government, and the Virginians said, if they can do that to Massachusetts, they can do that to us. And they were on board. And from that moment on, I think the revolution became inevitable.
The fear on the part of the American Republicans, the 18th century, the founders, who had studied ancient Rome and who had thought that the Roman Republic had failed because of moral decay. Is that why a republic has to be morally virtuous?
Yes. The republic is a fragile polity. Democracy is hard work, as we're finding out, I think, in the Middle East. You just don't put it together. Authoritarian governments come easy, but republics are fragile because they depend on the moral character of the people. And the Roman example was what they read about in the 18th century. Of course, they're thinking of England. Britain was considered to be the Rome of the 18th century, and it seemed to be in the process of decay and disillusion. And so Americans could compare themselves to the British and say that we are a more moral people. We're more simple. We're more austere. We don't have all that luxury. There's nothing like the great poverty of London and the gin slums of London in America. So we're a better, more morally superior people. That gave them the kind of confidence to undertake the revolution against what they thought was a decaying mother country.
So that faith in the goodness of the American people is the American idea.
Well, that's part of it. I think Americans, that's quite up for grabs now. Are we an exceptional people? Are we different from other people? That's the way the argument goes. Many academics don't believe that, and many people may doubt that too. But I think there's still that lingering sense by many Americans that they are better than people elsewhere. Whether that's true or not, we'll have to see.
Thank you, Gordon Wood, for speaking with us today about the birth of the United States. I'm Lewis Lapham of Lapham's Quarterly for Bloomberg News, copyright Bloomberg 2011.